Thank you so much for tuning into Let's Talk, the official podcast of the National Runaway Safe Line, or NRS. At NRS, we operate the federally designated national communication system for youth who have run away, are experiencing homelessness, or who may be considering leaving home. For over 50 years, we've provided crisis support and resources for young people, families, and communities across the nation. I'm extra excited about today's episode and conversation because it's all about protecting youth who identify as LGBTQIA2S+ and the tough realities they face in society today. I'm joined by two members of the Youth Outlook team. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourselves in the organization?
I'm Nancy Mullen. I'm the executive director of Youth Outlook. I identify as genderqueer, lesbian. Use pronouns interchangeably, please. So it's Nancy, she, her, Nando, he, him, and I default to they very easily.
Hey, my name is Carolyn Walskag. My pronouns are she or they. I am the director of programs at Youth Outlook.
Amazing. How long have you been at Youth Outlook, Carolyn?
Well, I think about this is my second time. So I collectively about 9 years, and then I've been back in this role for 2 years.
What is it that brought you back to the organization, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, you know, I started the pandemic running housing programs for youth experiencing homelessness and working in the child welfare field. And I had, previously been at Youth Outlook, and it was, working in housing is, I think, the best thing in the world and also the hardest thing in the world. And so after you can never turn your brain off. Not that you can turn your brain off in this job either, but I was ready for a change. You know, I had been working residential for 8 years, and so wanted to come back, and it kind of worked out perfectly. Just given with everything that's going on in the country, I was able to kind of devote some of my energies and talents to supporting schools and other folks with all this kind of anti-trans backlash.
I actually love that. I love hearing that, like, a big part of what's motivating you are the things that you're seeing out in the real world, and you're making informed decisions for your own life based on what things that are affecting other people and yourself, of course, but other people. How about you, do you have a preference? I know you go between the two very fluidly, but do you prefer, for the sake of this interview, Nancy or Nando?
Nancy's fine.
Okay, perfect. How long have you been with Youth Outlook?
How long have I been with Youth Outlook? I am celebrating 25 years this month.
Yeah, so the organization itself, if I'm not mistaken, is also celebrating 25 years, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, so what has changed over the past 25 years? I think I asked this question when we were in person in Louisville too, like what about the organization has really changed over the past 25 years, especially in ways that you're like really particularly proud of?
Yeah, wow, there's been tons of change for us. So I came in when the agency was about 6 months old. Prior to my arrival, we worked with just a volunteer group doing one drop-in center in DuPage County, which was fabulous. It was a fabulous way for us to get started. I was the first employee of the agency. And when I arrived, the early board members told me that it was their dream to see the agency continue to grow. So I took that really seriously, and we have grown from that first little drop-in center in the basement of the Hinsdale Unitarian Church to having services in 8 counties. That's 14 drop-in centers and parent support services and grandparent support services, youth leadership, HIV prevention work, and just a booming community education and professional development program. So there's been a ton of change for us. Our footprint on the state has grown tremendously. We have reached thousands of kids across this time. And probably the one thing that I noticed the most, the visible signs of what's been changing. When I first started in this job, I used to hear all the time that people didn't either think it was necessary or want to discuss this topic with me because they didn't think teenagers were old enough to know. They didn't think they had any kids like that enrolled in their schools. That was an urban issue. Kids were not dealing with out in the suburbs or in the rural areas. And in the past couple of years, it has been just eye-opening to watch all of those communities that resisted conversations, resisted acknowledging that they had LGBTQ youth at that time, all of them raising rainbow flags for Pride Month. And that's really noticeable around here, that all these little pride groups have popped up in these communities that did not want to acknowledge these children and these youth. And I think that's had some far-reaching effect.
Yeah, I mean, to speak to that, when I was looking for like the next place for me to live, essentially, I decided that like one thing that was really important was being able to feel like I have comfort in the place that I'm living. And like, so I was actively searching for, say, like queer spaces or places that presented themselves as a queer safe space without having to say it, so that it's so important to be able to like walk around, like for my partner who is non-binary and dresses genderqueer, to be able to walk around the neighborhood and feel comfortable. And you know, I'm from Nashville where you can't do that. So for me to see an organization that's out there like doing this work on the ground and making actual change, I mean, I can credit you for being a part of the reason that I moved here probably. Just to add a little bit of context for everyone listening, I had the amazing privilege of taking part of one of your sessions during a conference in Louisville with the National Safe Place Network. Can you talk just a little bit about what that session was about?
We were talking about current trends for LGBTQ youth, and we talked about the stats and the change in the coming out age and the differences between exploring sexual orientation and exploring gender identity, and which kids are tending to use our services right now. And it was really interesting to hear from people who were from a number of different states about what was going on with service provision to the kids in their area, compared to what we're seeing. And Carolyn and I both feel really fortunate to be working in a state that has a lot of built-in protections for LGBTQ youth, and hearing from the folks in that session that their kids were worried about healthcare access and security in their schools. Very eye-opening even for me.
Yeah, Carolyn, would you mind talking about some of the ways that the program has gone in the past couple of years since you've rejoined the organization?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when I first started as an intern in 2011, we had, I think, 3 drop-in centers at the time, and it was primarily for ages 16 to 20. And then, you know, we'd have a 15-year-old or a 14-year-old reach out, and I would say to Nancy, hey, I think we need to make our age a little bit younger. And then we got younger and younger, and through the years, started making our programs available for ages 12 to 20. Because in Illinois, you can consent to mental health care and STI testing, all that at age 12. And so our age range has shifted a lot. And then since I returned, that age number kept getting younger and younger. So people reaching out saying, well, that's great that you start at 12, but my 9-year-old just came out to me, or my 10-year-old did. What do we do? And so about a year ago, we started a program called Rainbow Sprouts, which is for kindergarten through sixth graders and their families, to talk about things at a developmentally appropriate way for their age, but to meet other people, whether they identify already as gay or non-binary, or they're exploring gender. Those are some of the labels we've heard from young people. And so, and families just want a place where their kids can feel community, feel similar. So we've expanded that program. And I think what we see in our drop-in centers is still trans and non-binary young people coming to us at all of our centers. We're seeing a lot of cisgender bisexual girls that are wanting support. And that seems to be a trend across the country. I think we're also seeing kind of the intersection of identities of young people who are neurodiverse, young people with disabilities, who not only want to be seen for their queer identity, but want to be seen and have programming that validates their other identities. So I think it's kind of converging to you know, hit all the different interests that our young people have right now.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you mentioned that, because we, at the time this episode airs, it will have been the previous season, but I just recorded an episode about invisible disabilities with members of our youth advisory board. And one of the first questions that I asked them was like, how do you identify? Like, do you identify yourself as disabled? Is it appropriate for people to use the label disabled to describe you? Like, what is appropriate there? And I learned so much from them just by giving them the space to let them talk about it themselves. I want to echo the fact that younger people are starting to reach out and seek these services that provide support and education for people. I think, like, I'm from the South. I would imagine that if you went where I was from and told people that you were giving, like, kids as young as kindergarten age education about those type of things, they would say, like, that's too young. What is your general response to people who think that way?
Well, I think it depends on who it is and do they want to engage in the conversation, right? So, you know, if that's a comment on our Facebook post versus someone who genuinely, you know, has that conversation. So I think some of the ways that I approach those conversations are kind of comparing when their children who may be cisgender and heterosexual, like when they started to first like form a crush or first show us their gender identity, that they like this color, that they want to wear these types of things. And that's developmentally appropriate for people as young as 3 or 4 to know like what clothes feel good, what, and those types of things. So we don't question when a fifth grader, when our fifth grade son tells us that he has a crush on another girl, right? We don't question that. And so just kind of helping people understand that that's around the time when people can start developing crushes. So for a child to tell us that they're bisexual or gay or lesbian at that age is just developmentally normal. It's just not something we've talked about a lot. So I try to make some of those comparisons. And then I think there's a lot of still fear that when we're talking about elementary school, that we're talking about sex, right? People think that that's what that's about. And just reminding people that we're talking about identities, we're talking about love, we're talking about family structure, not about sex, because people sexualize our community. And so just reminding people that like we are just talking about things that everyone is talking about, right? As a way, and some people receive that message, some people don't.
One of the things that I remember very vividly from the conversation we had at the National Safe Place Conference in Louisville was talking about how you guys had an event that was at like a, that I believe had to move maybe more than once because of people making threats to the organization about like working with young people, and to the point where you actually had to have like armed security. How, I mean, obviously it's super important for the organization to continue to be a safe space for queer people and to be open about that. How, I don't even know. I really want to get your like feelings about that now that it's been a little while since it happened, and like what you learned from that experience.
Sure, I can jump in on that one. What we learned from that experience is that we had a really nice ride for several years under a supportive administration that allowed us to have a lot of safety and enjoy a lot of privilege as our mm-hmm. youth felt more comfortable coming out. And then we did some steps backwards. We have regressed as a country around dealing with this issue. Our youth are definitely feeling the effect of that. I don't know that we had to learn that, because that was kind of the beginning as a foundation level of youth outlook. I mean, when we started the organization, we had to be aware of these things much more acutely than we did for the stretch of time where we felt comfortable. So what's been going on for the last few years feels very much like what we dealt with back in 1998, 1999, well into the 2000s. And then the benefit of that long stretch mm-hmm. of safety, I believe our country will get back there. I believe that our state, we're very fortunate that we do this in a state where we do have some built-in protections for our kids and our staff. But I think some of the things that we're dealing with right now they're very regressive. These questions have been asked and answered, and we need to continue to move forward and targeting some of the most vulnerable people on the planet. It to me, it just feels like half the country is punching down right now and aiming at some kids who don't have a lot of resources to start with. And we're trying to strip away even those few that they actually have. It feels dangerous, and it feels very, very short-sighted to me.
I feel like I did a poor job of like framing that situation. Will you give just a little bit of context behind the event that was happening?
Sure. So Well, we hosted an event called Trans Santa to allow like families to meet a transgender Santa Claus. And it really came about because our trans Santa was in a documentary for HBO Max called Santa Camp. So if anyone wants to check it out, I have, you know, my 15 seconds of fame. But so we, you know, posted on Eventbrite, shared in neighborhood Facebook groups, shared with our community, hey, we're having this event, you can come meet Santa. And that event was shared then with several different hate groups. And then they started calling the venue that we were hosting at, doxing some of the pastors that were running, were at that church, and really just creating chaos and then ultimately sending some threats. And so we had to move our location. Because we were partnered with HBO, they were able to hire security for us. And so we were able to have our event. And you can watch more in the documentary to see kind of how it all went down. It was a beautiful event, but it was frustrating. And, you know, I recognize being someone who lives in Illinois, we are not facing the pressure that our counterparts are facing. So I recognize that some people might be listening being like, that is our every single day, you know? So we have like so much protection in our state right now, and we still don't have a great time all the time, right? And so I think we're navigating like how that leads to our challenges now is thinking about none of us want to have barriers for young people to be able to access our services. Like we want young people to know that we exist, that they're not alone, that they can come. And now young people have to email us just to get our address, right? And that might not be something that people want to do. In some cases, families are the ones reaching out. So that's working, but I think that's a barrier that I consider a challenge. And, you know, thinking about which events do we post, where we'll be, those types of things is a barrier. Other of our counterparts in Illinois who are doing training and professional development, their work is getting FOIA'd in different school districts. And so we're always trying to stay a little bit under the radar of different groups, while at the same time not wanting to create this idea that we can't be seen, can't be proud of who we are. So it's this constant weight of making decisions. And it's stressful, right? Like it's going, like thinking about the safety of all of the events is stressful. And in some ways it's frustrating because we felt like we were past this and now we're here again. So now it's kind of looking back at, you know, what we learned at the beginning of our origins and looking back at our other queer ancestors who have like, you know, had to navigate this. What did they do? What can we learn from that? So I think that's a challenge still. And then that feeling for schools of, I want to teach this curriculum. I know this is good, but I'm afraid of the pushback I'm going to get. And so supporting school districts to remind people that it's good for all young people to learn about queer and trans people. And so I think that's kind of our other venue or avenue is trying to make sure that the other adults in our lives who don't feel as like the expert of this topic feel like they can build their capacity to support young people.
That's actually, you're getting to one of my next questions is like, there's so many, like, I think in our world, like, which I call the runaway and homeless youth community or the runaway and homeless youth world, I think that there are so many people who are under the misconception that parents often aren't involved in these situations, or that there's not like a guardian or a caregiver who's participating in this, or somebody that the young person can trust. For those people, especially when dealing with young queer people, who feel like it's unsafe for their kid to attend these type of events, or that they're just like maybe coaching their kid to not be so forthright about their identity and things like that. Do you have any advice for them for being a more supportive person without necessarily feeling like they're hiding for the sake of safety?
Well, I think it's okay to be afraid right now. I think fears are valid.
I'm so glad you said that, because I think that people want it to be like sunshine and rainbows and there's an answer and it's fine, just like push through it. But that's not the reality of it.
We're not going to push through this. Not in that way. Parents have a reason to be afraid right now. We're being threatened. We're being actively threatened. Our kids are being targeted in their community, in their schools. LGBT organizations as a whole are being targeted across the country. You sit in on some of the webinars that I sat in through this summer, and you just heard over and over, who canceled this event because they got an arson threat? Who canceled this other event because they had a bomb threat? Who's not able to do a training because they were threatened with some other kind of catastrophic event happening during what they were trying to do? I mean, we can't just walk through this blindly and hope for the best. That's probably, it's not going to be safe for us. We all need to be very cautious about what we're doing right now. I used the word dangerous a couple minutes ago, and I meant it. These are very dangerous times for us. And not, I'm not just mean us like Youth Outlook. I'm talking about the whole of the LGBTQ community.
I'm so thankful you said that, because I think, especially when people are like representing their organization, they don't want to say negative things like that, but that's just the reality of it. Is there a particular way that you explain this to a young person when they have questions about it, especially somebody like using your programs, if they have questions like, why is this person thinking this way? How do you talk to them about that?
Well, I think it's always helpful, right? This playbook of what's been happening to take away rights is not new, right? It's predictable. We can look at the past. And so I think the question is not so, or what I experience, it's not so much that young people are like, how do I navigate the danger? It's, but how do I have hope for the future? Like, how do I have hope? Or a parent saying, how do I help my kid who feels so defeated with the where we're going? And I think we look back at the history of organizers. I think we talk about what understanding what the protections we have in our state. So, you know, for example, the day that the Texas, was it the governor or the attorney general, like a year ago, said that supporting or affirming your trans child would be child abuse. I happened to sit in on one of the groups that night of young people living in Illinois. And they're processing this, digesting this, trying to understand, when's that going to happen for us? Are we next? And so helping them, one, just understand what our protections are here, helping them make informed decisions about maybe where they want to go to school, where they want to travel, looking at different maps of what protections you have or don't have in different states. But also like seeing what their interest is in getting involved, right? So is it that they want to organize at their school? Is it that they want to write letters to support young people in Arkansas or some of these states that we're seeing rollbacks? So like helping people feel like they're part of the narrative, because I think it's going to take all of us to push back on some of these rights that have been taken away by courts. I was, you know, reading Chase Strangio's Instagram post from this weekend, and he's like the lead attorney for the ACLU Trans Project, and was just like, some of the stuff that we're facing right now is going to take decades to undo. So how do we build, how do we come together as a community, still have joy, still have fun, and then like fight like hell when we have the energy, you know? And so I think that's some of the stuff that we do with our young people is like, sometimes it's like, let's focus and talk on that and digest and debrief everything that you're hearing. And sometimes like, let's put that aside and just like have the best time ever and learn like what color fits your mood or whatever they're doing, like paint rocks, like whatever feels good to you. So I think it's just this constant balance of like helping people like know that some of the stuff is insurmountable, but if we do it together, we can get through it.
And I think there's also, oh, I'm sorry, Carolyn.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think there's also an opportunity here that we shouldn't miss. In terms of looking at our community as a whole, the L, the G, the B, we've not always come out for our T siblings. We haven't done a good job of that. We especially haven't done a good job of that for our T siblings who happen to be people of color, most especially young ones. And this is an opportunity for all of us to step up. We need to step up. We cannot leave people behind in this process. So, I mean, we have to face the grim reality of what this is, but we need to come back together the whole of us, the L, the G, the B, the P, the T, the non-binary, everything. We need everybody on the front lines for this, because there is work to be done, and we're not going to be able to do this if we continue to fragment as a community.
Oh, hell yes. Thank you for saying that. I love that sentiment so much, because I strongly believe that so many people like talk about, and I will speak for queer, cisgender men, that like people that say like, oh, I know I need to work on like being more accepting of trans people and understanding their journey. And I'm like, you don't even treat like people who identify as lesbians like appropriately at when you go out. Like I know that a lot of women who identify as lesbian do not feel safe in spaces that are queer safe spaces, but they're really just gay safe spaces. So I'm like challenging anybody who's listening to this is to like absolutely like think about the ways that you are approaching unifying our community, especially the trans community, by also challenging the way that you like interact with all members of our community. And that includes like people of color, of course. Like there are so many different ways that you should be kind of pulling yourself back from the conversation to look at it from every perspective so that you don't just sound like an ass all the time. Sorry to go off on a tangent there, but I feel really strongly about that. You mentioned that during our class, is that like, it's not always like sometimes it's only a safe space for certain people. And like one of the things that I'm taking away from like Youth Outlook is that everything is about, or it's not everything is about, but everything is really centered around providing the young people with open communication and education so that they can make their own informed decisions, so that they're learning along the way and that like things aren't just being like handed to them and then they're pushed out the door. And I appreciate that education is such a big aspect of what your organization does. Can you talk about some of the educational opportunities that you guys offer?
Sure. So one of the ways that we help develop leaders is we have a youth leadership program. And so young people across all of our different drop-in centers can go through a training similar to what we put our adult volunteers through to learn things like conflict resolution, obviously, public speaking, the history of our organization, and facilitation skills. And so our youth leaders can then help be leaders within the organization, but also go out and do panels, be a part of different networks and coalitions and things like that. So that's one of the ways that we do education. I think other ways is just thinking about like what young people are interested in. And so one of our drop-in centers does like an alphabet night. So like they started with the L and then they learned all about the history of like where the word lesbian came from, famous lesbians from history, all sorts of different types of things. And then they'll come back to that alphabet night every once in a while and work their way through so that you can kind of get a full picture of a lot of the different letters, right? So we started with some of the ones that are more common and then we'll work our way through. So I think that's something we, for representing identities that maybe don't exist in our group. We love to do like bring in speakers, watch documentaries. We have an LGBTQ library in all of our centers. And so finding different ways to help young people kind of see themselves reflected in our groups, but also see windows into other queer and trans people's lives.
A lot of young people are learning about these things through non-traditional means, right? They're learning from the internet, they're learning from TikTok. How do you educate young people about like respecting the different aspects of identity politics and gender and thing like that, especially coming off the heels of the question or the statement about like especially queer or gay men not always spreading the love to the other parts of the alphabet community? I'm specifically thinking about like making sure that people understand the aspects of our community that are rooted in culture, like it being Two-Spirit, which is something that's like people are learning more about because it's penetrated pop culture, right? But it's not necessarily something that people should just pick up and identify themselves as. Same as Mahu. Both of these things I've seen pushed into prominence because of different queer-led television programs or movies or celebrities. And I immediately see people being like, oh, I'd like want to be just like her, so I'm going to identify this way. So to clarify, the question is, how do you educate young people about respecting gender identities that are wrapped in culture?
I'm so old that I find that they're educating me about that. Right? They're on top of that in a lot of the conversations that we have. They're leading that conversation and sharing their information with with our staff, who range in age from, you know, early 20s to in their 60s. So they've got a different grip on it. So my experience is the flip side of that. I'm actually learning from the conversations that I have with young people all the time. Carolyn, you can jump in and correct me if you think that's off base.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, one of our youth leaders just led part of our volunteer training on supporting BIPOC youth in our drop-in centers. And, you know, I think young people now have so much more access to terms. I think I probably didn't hear about Stonewall like until college. And, you know, I think our 14-year-olds are writing about it in their school papers and things like that.
Right.
So I think in many ways, young people have access to things like that. Outside of like our drop-in center youth, we do some community education for just 10th graders in our community, because part of their health class is learning about LGBTQ identities. And so that might be an introduction for some people that have never learned about those types of things. So we do talk about the idea of being two-spirit and how that's a word for Indigenous folks and not a word that that if you are white, right, that you get to use. And so I think it really depends on the audience, but a lot of our young people have more access. And then I think in terms of words that are related to like culture, so talking about the history of like how the word like slay and like yes queen and like all those things, like those didn't just like start with white gay men, right? And talking about the history and origins of like where words came from different drag scenes and things like that, I think those are conversations that are that we either bring up in the centers or that young people bring up. And I think we also like really try to create a culture where we set the set rules and we call them our ropes, but like our norms for group, and bring young new people into the fold of what those are, so that we're calling out like racist or oppressive language. So I think there's a lot of different ways that that happens. But right now, you know, I think what we try to tell the world is our young people have so much of this information. And so how do they get to share it with others? And then when we mess up, when we make mistakes, we call each other in and learn from that.
Love that. I have just a couple more questions. I am curious if you're willing to share any recent experiences where you felt like a young person really, like, maybe not caught you off guard, but like taught you something, felt like you changed your outlook on something because of the way a young person presented information or gave you new information.
I can think of a couple examples. In discussion with one of our young staff who works with a high school population now, we were talking about use of the word disabled person versus person with a disability. And my generation was taught it's always person first language. It's always a person with disability. And the staff person that I was talking about says, well, that people who have disabilities aren't surprised by the fact that they have a disability. So disabled person is actually what is now is being used. And that was really helpful for me to know that. And I can think of other kinds of circumstances where we talk about that use of language, where as things evolve, you know, I don't always catch things on the first pass. You know, sometimes I'm running to keep up because I've got my eye on one thing and, you know, four other things have happened that I've missed. So it's always a positive experience when one of the folks who comes to volunteer with us or somebody who's in youth leadership starts talking to us about, here's how these things have changed. This is what we're using now. Go for it. Carolyn?
Yeah, I recently did one of those 10th grade presentations for a school, and I'd been there the year before, and so they had the slides, and some of the young people were like, can I give some feedback and of things that they wanted changed? And one of the things that I used often when talking about the concept of intersectionality is an identity wheel. And if you Google like identity wheel, it comes up, and there's some that are kind of at the core of your identity and then some additional identities. So like the core identities are around like race, gender, ability, things like that. Outside might be geographic location, Are you a citizen? Those types of things. And, you know, just hearing from young people, they're like, we don't like that wheel. It does. It makes it look like we're prioritizing some identities over the other. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting perspective. Like, you know, sometimes you find stuff online and if you're like, oh, that really resonates with me. And it doesn't always resonate with everybody else. And so like taking that feedback, you know, I think the gender unicorn is a tool that I like because I think it's helpful to understand the difference between sexual orientation and gender identity. But not everybody likes that, right? And so coming up with different ways to help different brains understand that. And I think another thing that I'll be vulnerable and say that, like the pronoun, using pronouns like it and its was something that was like hard to get comfortable with. And maybe 10 years ago when young people would use that pronoun in our drop-in center, we would say, you're not an object, you know, like, can we use they or something like that. And we have this value of self-determination, but it was hard to use that because a lot of our young people were also called it and it's like pejoratively in school, I don't know what you are, you know, kind of thing. And so I think one of the things that we've been learning now and navigating, and some of our center staff do this much better than we do, is like recognizing that like it can be both and, right? Like so that might be like just as queer might not be a word that some older generations like, that's been reclaimed and is really powerful for young people. And the same is with it and its. And so I still sometimes register a little bit of discomfort with myself and, you know, maybe I'll be embarrassed to listen to this back, but like, that's where I am, you know, and I'm working on that. And so I think that's something that I've learned from my team about, and from listening to young people who say like, no, that pronoun feels really good to me. Like, I understand why that wasn't something that you've used in the past or whatever. So those are some of the things I've been learning.
It's interesting because it's a never ending shift, right? I mean, my partner came out as non-binary 4 years ago, and I still like find myself having to correct myself mentally to not say the incorrect pronouns because it's just like years and years of conditioning and teaching years of conditioning and teaching to try to like break those down isn't something that just happens overnight. And you had to, like, I told myself, oh, I know it's a journey, but like even after 4 years, it's like okay, I still automatically thought this way, and I'm like still having to try to unlearn that behavior. So I appreciate you sharing that vulnerability. Again, I feel like most people aren't as honest about those things as they should be, which is, you know, prohibitive to growth. When you guys do like interviews like these, are there ever questions that you feel like people don't ask, like that you wish that they would ask? I feel like when there's a big part of this podcast is trying to get the average person to understand the work that we do. And it's so nuanced that I feel like when you're interviewing questions, it's kind of like celebrities where they just get used to answering the same kind of like 15-ish questions over and over again. Are there any questions that you wish people would ask more that you know would help spread more information or answer the questions that they may not know to ask?
Well, I think when we talk about this population, it's so easy to go to like, this is the rates of homelessness, this is the rates of suicide, this is the rates of anxiety, depression, family rejection, all those types of things. But like talking about like all the amazing parts about being queer and trans, I don't think it's talked about enough. You know, we talk about what we're afraid of and all this stuff. But I think if you look at most queer and trans people, no one would trade their identities, right? There was this whole like push, you know, 10 years ago that like, born this way, we can't help it that we are queer, right? But like, and that narrative maybe helped some people to like get to acceptance, but it's not just like, don't just tolerate me or accept me because I just happen to turn out this way and you just have to deal with it, right? Like, there is so much joy and like, I know my world, I'm sure Nancy's world, and you know, so many of the people that we work with and our young people, we're part of communities that we never wouldn't have known if we were straight or cis, you know? And so there is so much joy. There is so much joy in this community. There is like the ingenuity, the ways that people have had to come together to survive, to build family, to like, to see the world that there's not just one way to be, right? Like all of that, like getting to be an example for my sister's kids, my nibblings of like, family can look a lot of different ways. Like that is joyful to me. And filling in a role, that young people need in their lives beyond their parents, right? That is joy and stuff like that. So I wish there would also, you know, be focus on like, what are all of the ways and things that will unfold by being part of the LGBTQ community? So yeah, that would be me. What about you, Nancy?
I would add to that, it's not too different of an idea, is that we want to keep in mind and ask questions around how our population is growing, because we've estimated us to be a very small percentage of the population overall, but we know from looking at the more recent information that's come out on our current high schoolers that it's probably more like double what we have always estimated LGBTQ people are in the population. And I was just doing a presentation for, believe it or not, a hospice group on LGBT end of life issues. Not a topic you deal with a lot in youth services, but it was something I had agreed to do as kind of a favor to an organization. And what I found out in my research for that is that even they are looking at, in the next 10 years, the number of LGBTQ clients that they're serving more than doubling. Mm-hmm. We're a significant part of the population. If this statistic holds true, in the coming, probably 15 years, we're going to be a quarter of the population. It is not like we're going anywhere. So there's a lot to know about us. There's a lot to include us in. There is a lot of talent and a lot of skill to be tapped into in our community. And this current push to kind of silence us and erase us, it cannot be more short-sighted.
Yes, I am with you 100%. I agree that I think a lot of the issues that we're facing are because the 90% of what we see in the media about queer people is bad news. It's either, and you know, what's funny, it's hardly ever like a queer person perpetuating some type of heinous crime, but quite the opposite of them experiencing it. So, when I look at the data, the Trevor Project does a mental health survey every year, and it just gets the number of young people who talk about how meaningful and important it was for them to be gendered correctly is growing and growing, because they're like, hey, this is something that's important to me. This is something that does mean something, which is why, you know, it means so much to me that you guys make such a strong effort to always be like allowing the youth to express themselves in ways that resonate with them more than anything else. I can't help but think that so many people unintentionally force their biases on people just trying to be like, well, I'm just trying to help, or I'm just trying to make sure that you stay safe. So I really appreciate you guys always being honest and open and keeping those form of communication open with young people so that they can like build actual trust with you. The more I interview young people for this podcast, I haven't heard a single one of them say that they had like multiple adults in their lives that they felt like they could truly trust and be open and honest with. And with that, is there anything else that you want people to know about Youth Outlook that you want especially young people to take away from this podcast episode?
So, you know, wherever you are, wherever you're listening, there's resources available to find community and people that want to know you and be a part of your life. And so some of the places that you can find that would be if you look up Centerlink or Google Centerlink LGBTQ Center, that has almost all the LGBTQ youth centers across the country. If that is challenging, you can find Youth Outlook and send us a message no matter where you are, and we can try and find you and get you connected to a center. If you're between the ages of 13 and 19, there's a great organization that we partner with called Q Chat Space, and they run virtual support groups every day of the week, sometimes in Spanish, sometimes for ACE and ARO people, for BIPOC folks, for trans femme people. We facilitate them on Fridays. And so there's a lot of places to connect beyond just calling like the crisis lines. There's a lot of support out there. And, you know, we're happy to help you find community.
Am I correct in assuming that much like us, you guys are not just like open to anyone that's experiencing a crisis, but anyone who just, even if they have like a young person that has questions about things, you're also willing to help them?
For sure.
Awesome. Anything to add to that, Nancy?
I would say the story is just beginning, and there's so much amazing stuff out there. When you find your network, when you find your people, it gets really exciting. So hang in there with us and come see us.
Yes, stay strong. and use the description for this episode to find links directly to Youth Outlook's website. And I also encourage you to find different ways to support youth who identify as LGBTQIA2S+ in your community. I also want to thank you for tuning into the Let's Talk podcast once again. There's one more episode in season 5, so it's the perfect time to get caught up. We've had some really incredible episodes featuring members of our own Youth Advisory Board and this National Runaway Prevention Month series featuring our National Runaway Prevention Month partners. Oh, and that reminds me, it's never too late to register as a National Runaway Prevention Month partner. You can visit 1-800-RUNAWAY.org/NRPM to learn more about National Runaway Prevention Month and the ways that you can give back to your community all year long. See you next time.